A word or two about our program to contextualize today's discussion. We've spent the past 2 weeks exploring the phenomenon of conversion. Conversion is a fact of life, to a certain extent a significant one in all religious traditions. There's a constant process of different religions drawing adherents, seducing adherents, people undergoing change of religious identity on principled grounds, because of faith, because of encounters with God, etc. And we've looked at this theme of conversion from the perspectives of five different religions: Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, and Buddhism. We've done so through the presence in our midst of five scholar practitioners who both belong to those traditions and who teach them in academic institutions worldwide. In the context of discussing conversion, we were forced to deal with a topic that many of us might initially feel uncomfortable with, but is nonetheless important in exploring the meaning of conversion. And that is, what happens when a person takes on a new religious identity without letting go of his old religious identity? It's one thing to say, yesterday I was Jewish, today I'm Christian. But what happens when a person says, now I'm both this and that? And increasingly, in the world, we encounter the phenomenon of people wanting to be more than one thing. Harvey Cox presented us with an analysis of the contemporary situation in which there's a kind of supermarket mentality where people pick and choose, mix and match, take from here and from there. We've reflected on the legitimacy, the illegitimacy, authenticity, inauthenticity of such a phenomenon. But no matter which way we look at it, it is a given that increasingly we live in a world in which there are multiple religious identities. And therefore, we chose today and tomorrow to reflect on various elements of this phenomenon of borrowings, multiple religious affiliations. I must say at the outset that the fact that we are discussing this doesn't mean that we necessarily agree, or for that matter, disagree with the phenomenon. Our primary mandate is to be holding conversations as members or representatives of different religious traditions. And as such, we should be representing the pure forms and not the hybrid forms. But nonetheless, hybridity is a reality, and we're wanting to have a look at that reality from the perspective of different religions. So today we'll be looking at the theme from Judaism and Christianity's perspective, and tomorrow we'll be looking in from Islam, Buddhism, and Hinduism. It is my task in the coming hour or so to share with you some reflections on the question of how to approach the subject of multiple religious traditions from a Jewish perspective. A subject that has barely been dealt with. I can think of almost no literature to help inform a person's thinking on it. And to a certain extent, that very fact indicates how problematic the theme is, because it goes against the very grain of tradition. Tradition strives for a uniform, uncompromised identity, and therefore it is natural that tradition will not seek to account for various forms of hybrid identities. So consequently, there's a reflection here that is to a certain extent original, initial, and of course it suffers from the weakness of that. Let's begin by posing the question, why should we even be dealing with this question from a Jewish perspective? And in classical Talmudic fashion, I can offer two answers, one lechatchila and one bidi'avad. In other words, one a priori, ideal, theoretical, and one taking into account reality, perhaps bemoaning the fact that reality is as it is, but nonetheless having to come to terms with the reality. And these two levels of the ideal and the reality correspond to two different perspectives, one referring to Jews and one referring to Judaism. So from the perspective of Jews, of people, of individuals who may be caught up in various complex religious identities, this is the level that I would refer to as bidi'avad, it is already on the ground, this is the situation. The fact is that in the modern reality, we encounter many phenomena of borrowings from other religious tradition. We encounter the creation of religious identities that are complex. And the scale of this phenomenon is staggering. I think we all recognize that there is not a religious movement in the world, a cult, a sect, a religion, no matter what you call it, that does not number a major number of Jewish adherents. They are literally everywhere. As they pass through Jerusalem, you encounter a rich mosaic of complex religious identities reflecting the various journeys that people have gone through. It is simply a fact that Jews come to Judaism in one way or another, or Jews pass through, or Jews represent more than simply the old faith of their fathers. Now, we could, of course, claim that this is a negative phenomenon, something undesirable. We could classify it together with a host of other undesirable phenomena that the modern and postmodern world present us with. That is one option. Let's call it the Mea Shearim option. Okay, it's all bad, and therefore why deal with it? The alternative is just like we attempt to struggle with a range of issues that modernity presents us with, we attempt to struggle with this question. We try to make sense of it. We try to find parameters of how to deal with it. And furthermore, we try to reflect upon its religious significance. Is there ultimately some form of hidden, higher meaning to the fact that so many Jews are going through so many places as part of their spiritual quest? Or is this simply a negative phenomenon that we should attempt to either ignore or uproot? So what I'm attempting here is an initial kind of theological response to the questions that emerge and that are necessary because people come and people are in need of guidance. And if you need to guide people, you have to have certain parameters from within which you address them. So the very fact that there are people and that these people need some direction and some orientation and you have to be able to engage them in an intelligent conversation necessitates this kind of reflection. On a more principled level, on the level of the lechatchila, there's a question concerning Judaism itself. What does it mean that so many people are unable to find their spiritual home within Judaism? Is this purely a matter of negative historical circumstance? Does this teach us something about today's Judaism? Do we assume that Judaism in its present historical manifestation is perfect and that all problems result from the lives and personal histories of the individuals with whom we deal with, from the fact that they don't know Judaism sufficiently, that they are unfaithful, etc.? Or is there a more fundamental problem in Judaism as a spiritual phenomenon? Is there something lacking in Judaism that necessitates people going out and getting things in other places? Okay, are we perfect? Are we imperfect? If we're willing to acknowledge the possibility that we are imperfect, then we've got to think about what it is that people are getting out there and how to deal with that. My starting premise is that, in a deep sense, Judaism is in a spiritual crisis. Okay? And whoever cannot accept this starting premise may have difficulty following with everything that will follow. Because my sense is that when you look at other religious traditions and you see what they have to offer, you come to the realization that there may be something lacking within Judaism. And this lack calls for reflection. So it is not that Judaism is wrong. It is not that Judaism is outdated. That's not the point I'm making. But I would say both empirically and in relation to its own ultimate statements of what it aspires to, we're just coming out of period of Tisha B'Av, that is a period of designating the fact that we recognize a lack, we recognize a crisis, and this touches upon the temple, upon prophecy, about the sense of God's closeness, about the meaning of the spiritual life, about how we live our Judaism, all those issues all those issues could represent, and in my opinion do represent, points in which Judaism, seen from its ideal perspective, both as far as its ultimate hope and aspiration and as far as its classical articulations in the sources, can be said to be in a situation of crisis. Consequently, this kind of hybridity may have potential for dealing with this particular crisis. So rather than see it as a purely negative phenomenon, we should be open to the possibility that it may be doing something positive in the long term for Judaism's own spiritual struggle. Now, the traditional-minded Jew might pose the question, what does the halakha have to say about all this? And I would like to begin with a little story that illustrates this problem. A story, a personal story I had some 25 years back, as a yeshiva student who felt a certain lack in his devotions, and for some reason, rightly or wrongly, and that's immaterial at the moment, decided he had to go practice meditation. At the time, TM was in vogue, and as a yeshiva student, the natural thing to do was to try and see if the rabbis don't object to it. So I always aim high, and therefore I went to have a consultation with the late Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach on the subject. Now, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was one of the two, three leading rabbinic halachic authorities in all of world Jewry. We're talking about a world-class figure in terms of his halachic ability. I went to his home here down the road in Shari Chesed, got a hold of him sometime after Mincha, and naively put the question to him if I could meditate or not. He looks at me, and he says, tell me something, did your grandfather meditate? I say to him, no, my grandfather didn't meditate. So he says, look, I see he fared well. He has at least one successful grandson. If your grandfather didn't meditate, you don't need to meditate either. What does this say? This says that to a halachic-minded person, and I'm not faulting this, he lives in a world in which there's a self-contained system that is intact, it's perfect, it has the sense that it can control reality, direct it, and give it the contours it needs to have. Halakha as such, as an autonomous system, may well not be in crisis. But the fact that the halachic mind may conceive the world in a way that doesn't recognize the crisis does not mean that on the ground, in the life of Jews, and ultimately in the life of Judaism itself, there is no crisis. So, starting from this crisis, we have to reflect on how do we deal with it in the given the fact that there is this complaint. Why didn't he pose to me the question of what is meditation? Why didn't he try to get deeper into it? Why was his response immediately, did my grandfather do it? Well, I think this suggests a basic sense in which any encounter with the outside is threatening. And the classical Jewish attitude is one of defensiveness, protection. We come out of a history full of forced conversions, non-forced conversions, assimilation, worry about the demography of the Jewish people, concern with the survival of the Jewish people, all important, significant concerns. This tends to create an attitude of inwardness, putting up boundaries, and hence most people prefer to not deal with this question. And I think this is what I encountered, someone who would simply rather not deal with this question and say, continue the paradigm of your grandfather. Now, in dealing with this question, I would like to pose a preliminary question, simply to test that, you know, that everyone should give the answer to himself. And this is a question that I've had to pose to myself many times, especially in dealing with Jewish converts to Christianity, which push my buttons and necessitate some Buddhist reflection on how I work and what my own internal mechanisms are. The question is the following: is it preferable to be secular without religion at all, or is it preferable to belong to another religion? Okay, I'm talking about a Jewish person. Is it better that a nice Jewish boy and a nice Jewish girl, that they should be, you know, just regular chilonim, living the lifestyle of quote-unquote Tel Aviv, Or is it better that they join some religious movement and have a spiritual dimension in their lives, but God forbid that religious dimension should not belong to Judaism, but should belong to another religion? Now, let's bracket for a moment what we might jump with as our instincts as terms of isur and heter, prohibited and permitted, the whole categories of halakha and the propriety and impropriety of halakha. But let's consider for a moment the case of Sufism or Islam or various situations that don't involve us in that. Okay? Our instinct is, and our history has been, that we've made our peace with the secular life. Yes, it threatens us, but somehow we've come to terms with it because it is religiously neutral and hence religiously less threatening. And we tend to assume it's better a person should have no religion than the other religion. Right? That I think for most people that is the instinct, because somehow that is deemed to be safer. And I'd like to pose the question, to what extent have we really reasoned this position, or is this simply an instinct that emerges out of our own tendency to be isolated, to define our boundaries? The secular person ultimately in some way is indebted to us for his religious identity, even if he may not practice it, but the religion he doesn't practice is defined by us. If you move to another religion, then there's an alternative definition of what constitutes religious identity. And I would argue in a deep sense that is more threatening. Now, how do we assess a situation like this? From the perspective of the spiritual life, wouldn't it be better to argue that the fact that someone has a spiritual life, has a living relationship with God, is better than someone who doesn't have one at all? We explored yesterday, we had in this room some fascinating discussions, even with a member of Hare Krishna, a secular kibbutz person from Kibbutz Gash, knew nothing about religion except for communism, and discovered the love of Krishna, who he, in his own way, argues is the same God as us in a different manifestation. What's better? Is it better to have a spiritual life or not to? To what extent do we assume that it is better to remain secular because ultimately we believe in some way or another the secular person will tomorrow come around to being religious? And then when he does that, he'll be religion on our terms. And what if not? What if ultimately it's a choice in the long run between nothing and something else? Would we rather deny a relationship with God in the name of upholding our religion? I'm leaving it as a question. I just want us to explore our hidden premises as we move on to this discussion. So let's move now to the whole question of relationship with other religions. And I think we can't discuss this question before first articulating what is actually the problem. If we enter this conversation assuming we shouldn't, but why not? Until we've defined why not, we can't deal with either how yes is or within what boundaries yes. So I'd like to present four different models or options for why it is problematic to have relations from the Jewish perspective with other religions. And to a certain extent, not excluded, but to a certain extent, I'm reworking here the thesis of Moshe Halbertal and Avishai Margaliot in their book Idolatry, where they present four different options on what the issue with idolatry is from the Jewish perspective. Option number one, a matter of faithfulness. So, adhering to the religion is a form of faithfulness, and not adhering to the religion is a form of betrayal. Let's explore that. Jewish religion is grounded in the concept of covenant. Covenant, a biblical notion, assumes God takes a people as an exclusive partner to a relationship, and he says, you follow me, you don't follow someone else. So the core structure of Jewish religion emerges through the concept of the covenant, and covenant demands exclusivity. A cursory glance at the Bible suggests this exclusive demand for serving the God who is described as the jealous God who makes no room for the worship of any other God. Now this, of course, informs our basic religious approach in a very, very profound way. So it's ingrained there. There's no room for serving any other God. You have to be exclusively faithful to the one God. The problem is that this faithfulness extends way beyond the parameters of the covenantal definition of who God, our partner, the covenant, is. Because in the original, we're talking about faithfulness to God, to the identity, to the object of worship. But when we look at our sense of faithfulness, it's actually much wider. Because what happens when it is the same God who's being proclaimed by another religion? Not a different God, not Baal, not Chemosh, but the same God. But you're worshiping him now in a different way. So our sense of faithfulness is actually extended not only to the identity of who you're worshiping, but also to the forms of worship. And beyond that, we've developed an identity, a sense of faithfulness to our national identity. So therefore, there's a sense of faithfulness to the people. As one convert from Judaism to Christianity that we spoke with said, you know, the basic problem was that people look at him as a traitor. Okay? And their concern is not that he's serving the wrong God, but he becomes a traitor because he's a traitor to the Jewish people for having converted. So there's, and you could even say there's a way of being unfaithful to the Jewish story, to the continuity of the Jewish story. So there's a lot of elements that go into faithfulness, beginning with the identity of the object of worship, but moving far beyond that. Now, to take this example, a Jew, Orthodox, in his practice, Orthodox, and that, or rather, Orthoprax, I should say, right, who believes that Jesus Christ is the Messiah and who wants to also participate in Christian worship, he doesn't affect, he's not unfaithful to God, is he? He only understands him differently. But he's unfaithful to the Jewish people. He's unfaithful to the memory of the Jewish people. Okay, so sense of faithfulness and betrayal is a very, very central element in shaping our attitude. And of course, the challenge here is what happens when you preserve the same God, but you expand the story. You don't tell the story as the Jews do through their history, but you tell the story through another prophet, Jesus, Muhammad, Baha'u'llah, it doesn't matter who. But you basically maintain the identity of the object of worship, but you know to tell another chapter in the story. And what are the implications of that from the perspective of faithfulness and multiple religious identities? That's option number one for problem. Option number two, error. This is the philosophical position expounded by Maimonides. If you serve another God, if you serve a God with the wrong understanding, if you serve the Trinitarian God, in all those cases, you're simply in error. It's a philosophical problem. Maimonides lived in a world in which he could speak in absolute terms of true and false. He had these absolute categories. I'm not convinced we still live in a world in which terms of true and false and absolute truths still have the same power. Once we talk philosophy, it's not inconceivable that someone might find various reasonings of Eastern philosophies to have greater appeal. And in a post-Aristotelian world, we don't have any more of those absolute yardsticks for true and false. So of all the categories this has played in shaping our consciousness, I would argue that today it's the most complicated category to use simply because we lack an absolute definition for what constitutes true and false. But nonetheless, we have to be aware of the category of error. Category number three, danger. Nachmanides, Ramban, discusses the theme of idolatry not as something erroneous, invalid, a cognitive error, as Maimonides would have it, but as a danger. You're connecting with negative powers, okay, with satanic powers, demonic powers. They're real. They're threatening. They're dangerous. And don't deal with them, because if you deal with them, you could bring harm upon yourself. This is an important criterion, I would argue, especially in dealing with what we term cults, even though we have a difficulty in defining what cults are exactly, but you know, in some loose sense, we can attempt to apply this category of dangers. Okay? Now, this category at least has unlike the category of error, has some way of being verified. Because you can argue, well, if we're dealing with a category of danger, well, let's check. Let's check the lifestyle. Let's check the hygiene. Let's check, you know, what kind of fruit this thing bears. Well, look at the people today. You need longer time. Look at them a generation down the line. You'll have a sense. They're living good lives. They're living bad lives. It's a legitimate argument. Meir makes the argument concerning Christians and Muslims that they're not idolaters because of their lifestyle. So lifestyle can be a way of judging if someone is good or bad. But at least the argument is it's dangerous because in some way it's not threatening to our sense of identity and loyalty, but there's real harm, moral harm, spiritual harm, energetic harm. We have to also take into account that once we apply this category of harm, we have to consider it not only outside Judaism, but inside Judaism. What forms are there inside Judaism that are harmful? Are all forms of religiosity practiced by amulet dispensers and incantors, as opposed to cantors, etc. Do they all match up to this criterion of spiritual hygiene? Is there a possibility of danger within the tradition themselves? This is a very important one of for discovering the intra-traditional forms of idolatry. And the fourth model that's problematic is the problem not of the false identity of the object of worship, but the false form of worship. The argument, and probably its greatest herald is Rabbi Yehuda Halevi in his Kuzari, is not that the other guy doesn't get right who the identity of the partner in the religious worship process is, but he just worships them in the wrong way. You can't worship God unless you worship God in the way that God tells you to worship him. And therefore, if you attempt to devise your own religion or to use a religion that doesn't have a divinely ordained way of happening, then you got it wrong. So there's a problem both of the identity of the object of worship, but also the form of worship. Now, of course, this is only relevant as long as we talk in terms of worship. What if instead of talking of worship, we talk about the spiritual life? What if we talk about wisdom? What if we talk about other things that are not doing God's will and worshiping him? This whole logic of proper and improper worship follows a paradigm that's a deeply Jewish one of worship, mitzvah, commandment, all those notions that other traditions may not be operating with. So there's a lot of leeway here if you don't define certain things as worship, but define them as, in a much wider sense, as the movement of the spiritual life. Okay, now, so the question then is there a way of distinguishing between the service of God and the spiritual life conceived in a wider sense that would allow us to develop some positive relationship to other religious traditions, bracketing the question of worship? Now, it's clear that having laid out these four options, and I'll repeat them again, right? We said faithfulness, error, danger, and proper form of worship. We now are absolutely fully equipped to deal with every spiritual phenomenon under the sun. All we need to do is to look at it and to decide which of these four options it violates and why it's prohibited. The problem is, of course, trying to figure out in relationship to each particular phenomenon what exactly is the problem. If we take the attitude that all problems are relevant, and we see faithfulness in the widest possible sense, then we could come up with a wonderful conclusion that any encounter with anything outside Judaism is simultaneously treason, error, danger, and false worship. And I would say that this has been the classical attitude of the masses and of the mass of rabbis to argue that you don't really need to go into any of the details of what another religion is made of, because it is all of the above. Just to deal with it as a form of treason, not to mention error, not to mention the fact that it's dangerous. So why even touch it? Well, why touch it? I've addressed that question before. So therefore, given the fact that I consider reality to be complicated, and that I don't think that the helpful direction for reflection on this is to throw everything out in a global way, we have to establish certain parameters that will guide us in in what way we can even speak meaningfully of borrowing a relationship with other traditions. And of course, in light of the above four categories, we would have to keep the following four categories in mind. A, an attempt to maintain a sense of fidelity to God, to the Torah, and to the nation, so that no matter where we go, there would have to be, I would use this as a very important criterion for defining the yeses and noes from a Jewish perspective, sense of fidelity, God, Torah, and tradition. Two, there would have to be some attempt to assess in an imminent way the quality of life and the contribution of what it is that is actually drawn from the other. This is the danger. Three, an avoidance of a conscious element of alternative worship of God. This addresses the criterion of false worship, so that whatever it is that you're in contact with would be something other than worship, at least as defined Jewishly. And to whatever degree it's possible, given our postmodern condition, which is so different than the Maimonidean situation, is there any threshold of error that we could at least avoid, or is it meaningful at all? Okay? So with these four criteria, let's now look at different possibilities for what is actually happening on the ground. So let me move on to the next stage of my presentation, in which I want to list the various components by means of which religious identity is created. What is it that, in the case of a Jewish person, I think this, the terms I list are actually relevant in a wider way, that provide the definition of a person's religious identity? And I list here seven criteria, and then I'll play these seven out in various situations. One, religious identity as a component of your own subjective self-understanding. We met yesterday with a Buddhist, and we asked him, what is Jewish about you? His answer was, I feel Jewish. Okay? And then he then goes ahead and gives expression to that in A, B, C, and D. But the basic sense is a subjective identification, a kind of assent, a willing to belong to the community and to feel yourself a part of it. Number two, this subjective identity finds expression in outward symbols, okay? A code of dress, okay? Language, whatever. Three, sharing in the common story. I think this is a very important element, okay, that you feel yourself part of the collective, not simply subjectively, but you tell its story, you share in its story, you move with its story. Fourth, willingness to accept the faith claims or the worldview of the tradition. Five, acceptance of the lifestyle of the tradition. Of course, here we encounter the norm, the halakha. Six, recognition of the authority structures of the tradition, the objective structures by which it mediates its wisdom and its tradition. And seven, and this is the most complicated, recognition of the above, or some combination of the above, as meaningful channels for spiritual perfection, for being a path, for being your way of salvation. Okay, so the recognition that the ensemble of all of the above, okay, and I list them again, subjective sense of identity, its outward manifestations, sharing in the common story, sharing in the faith, lifestyle, and authority structures, all of the above in some way constitute a path, a whole, something total that serves as a means for your salvation as your spiritual way. This is how you go, this is how you get there, no matter how it is you define that there. So let's look at multiple religious identities in light of these seven criteria and in light of the four models of what would be wrong in borrowing. Now, I don't think it's to be expected that, given the fact that the basic situation is one of crisis, that in dealing with people who have complex religious identities, we'll find someone who can totally buy lock, stock, and barrel all seven components. Because if one of them is accepting the religious authority structures, and you cannot totally identify with an authority structure of a system that's in crisis, then there's a certain level in which you're not going to be able to identify with everything. So that means that we're going to have to find some sense of how to connect to it in a meaningful way, at least in a partial meaningful way, rather than a total. Okay, so I think given that there's a crisis, there's no way of totally buying into it. So we'll have to find some fundamental level necessary in order to maintain religious identity from a Jewish perspective that somehow addresses all of the above. Now the question is, can a person maintain the same kind of relationship on all seven points simultaneously to two different religious traditions? Okay? Is it even conceivable that on the level of subjective feeling and religious practice and faith structures and feeling this is the path, etc., etc., you'll feel that both Judaism and Buddhism, both Judaism and Christianity, both any two religions can. I think it's, we just heard the answer. The authoritative answer, of course, is no. So I think intuitively we all recognize that this is an impossibility, because there are obviously conflicts between them. You can't absolutely accept the authority claims of two traditions, absolutely accept the claims that two religious traditions are the means for salvation. So therefore we've got to define the way. What does it mean to have a relationship with two religions at the same time? Okay, and I'm going to present now three different models of how it is possible to have these relationships, given the fact that I think it's impossible to have full participation along all seven categories I've just listed. First model, and I'm presenting it from the order of what I think is unfavorable to the third model that I think is possible. Okay, so at least you can follow the course of my presentation. Well, let me just tell you what they are, so it's clear for you. The first one is conversion while making some attempt to maintain ties with your earlier identity. The second model is the attempt to play on both grounds at the same time. And the third is firm affiliation with one tradition, in this case Judaism, with a kind of selective borrowing and inspiration from another tradition. So let me now work out all three options. So the first option is that of abandoning your former religious identity and adapting a new one, while maintaining some kind of nominal relationship to your original religious identity. Now, in the case of Judaism, this is very easy. This may not be the case with other traditions. In the case of Judaism, it's easy because Judaism is both a people and a religion. So therefore, it's very easy for a person to simply say, I'm a Jewish because, as the guy said yesterday, he's a follower of Hare Krishna, but he has a Jewish mind and body. He's part of the Jewish people. So once there's an ethnic definition, then we have no problem saying, yes, of course I'm Jewish, but we refer to that ethnically, and then we refer to something else religiously. Now, together with this kind of, I would say, low-grade identification with Judaism, the first level of identity formation, right, the ascent thing, feeling yourself Jewish, you can move along with certain customs, certain dress, speak Yiddish, eat gefilte fish, do things that make you feel Jewish, while drawing most of your relationship with the outside, spiritually. Now, in this case, what happens is that your self-identity preserves a relationship with Judaism, but spiritually, you're drawing from somewhere else. And hence, your relationship to those identity-forming features is only to the lower rungs on the ladder, subjective consciousness and outward expression. There's no total acceptance of the tradition, there's nothing normative, there are no authority structures, and above it all, there's no sense that this is the spiritual path. To the best of my knowledge, I may be mistaken in this, to the best of my knowledge, and we did have one day devoted to this theme, in many circles of Messianic Jews, this is, as far as I can ascertain, what goes on by way of religious identity. Namely, you feel yourself Jewish, and you engage in a service that is phenomenologically closer to being Christian than it is to being Jewish, and you do that by wearing a kippah, putting on a talit, possibly reading from the Torah, using various identity markers that are external, and therefore you're maintaining those first two levels. The first level of feeling Jews, being part of the collective, the second one using the external markers, while not moving to any of the other elements. Now, there could, of course, be other models of Messianic Jews. I'm not arguing that they're all the same. I want to be careful on this. But at least some of what I heard in this room certainly fit into this category. Or, significantly, the saving story is the story of the New Testament, right? Part of a new canon, a new scripture, and not the saving story of Judaism and its history. I'll tell you another story. I go, for the past number of years, annually to the meeting in the United States of the American Academy of Religion, which is the big carnival of religious studies. It takes place once a year, and everyone under the sun comes there. They have a very, very large book fair there, which is itself, you know, one of the reasons to come. All the religious book publishers publish there. One of the publishers that exhibits there regularly is called ISKCON. ISKCON is the initial of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. That's the press of the movement popularly known as Hare Krishna. We just mentioned them earlier. So I passed through the booths, you know, strolling around looking, and the guy sitting at the ISKCON booth targets me in Yiddish. So, you know, we engage each other. And then to my surprise, Stewie does this to me. Opens his shirt, pulls out tzitzis, like that. Hare Krishna pulls out tzitzis. Conversation continues. And I discover that Stewie puts on tefillin every day. We go on, and I discover that Stewie's Shomer Shabbos. So there's a Shomer Shabbos, right, a Sabbath observant, putting on tefillin, putting on tzitzis, and he's a member of Hare Krishna. I'm going too much into Stewie's story, and I don't know enough of it, but to me, it would seem to be a case of a person doing precisely that. His path has become that of Krishna consciousness, and yet he wants to maintain ties to his former religious identity, which he does by means of all of the above. And I'm not knocking it. I'm not knocking his observance of commandments. You know, at the end of the day, he may be better off than many balubatim, you know, simple, ordinary folk who get up at 6 in the morning, go to synagogue for 20 minutes, and come back. A lot of what goes on within Judaism, of observant Jews, is just that, maintaining the collective identity. There's a lot of what goes on in Jewish religious tradition that is not about spirituality, about encounter with God, about personal transformation. It's about maintaining your identity as a Jew through the particular worship that you undertake. Well, this guy's got the best of both worlds. He knows he's Jewish, right? He identifies himself immediately in that way. And at the same time, maybe he has some form of a spiritual life. So, without criticizing it too far, but I do want to pose the question, what kind of a phenomenon do we have here? I would argue, of course, ultimately, that this is not the ideal format for multiple reasons. First of all, because Stewie's kids are not going to put on tefillin and tzitzis and keep Shabbos. Maybe they will, maybe I'm wrong. But more significantly, because ultimately Stewie's path is that of Krishna consciousness. And he's obviously found something in that tradition that he didn't find in Judaism. But at the same time, he's had the need to maintain some form of identity within Judaism. So this is first left. People taking on another religious path and trying to hold on to their identity by various external markers, as we've just seen, some of which even go into the realm of mitzvot and normative Jewish life. Now, let's move on to the second type, which is that of multiple religious identities, meaning that a person feels himself simultaneously to belong to more than one religious tradition. Now, that means that a person is willing to say, I am, and under this I am, he places two things, both Judaism and something else. Now, I would argue it is impossible to claim that you are affiliated with more than one religious tradition without, in some way, there being a primary and a secondary affiliation. I think it's impossible that there that the two affiliations should be absolutely equal. In some sense, once you probe, you discover that one affiliation is primary, the other is secondary. Now, let's go through our list of various categories to think what would be the minimal requirements necessary for adopting for maintaining a Jewish religious identity. Well, elements one and two, right? The subjective feeling Jewish and the outward expressions. Well, they of course are the easier, and we've decided they're really insufficient. Okay. Now, authority structure I certainly wouldn't list as a major thing, because a person in crisis can't be expected to accept the authority structures of the tradition. So therefore, there are three elements that are left now under discussion. It would seem to me that in such a case, observance of the mitzvot would be, Jewish orthopraxy would be fundamental. The question is, it's a necessary condition. The question is if it's a sufficient condition. Must one also believe in everything in Judaism? Is it enough to be fully observant, or must one also believe in the way Jews believe? Must one also sense that Judaism is the spiritual path one is walking? Both questions are, at face value, you would argue, of course you do. And yet, both to argue that you need to have this way of thinking, of course, imposes a certain definition of what Judaism is. Is Judaism a sum of action? Is it a faith? Is it a path? I think so. And yet, when pushed, one recognizes that there's something tenuous, maybe subjective, about all our various constructs of Judaism. I mean, the Judaism that we practice, after all, historically, is in some way an amalgam of ancient biblical and rabbinic thinking together with the mixture of Greek Hellenistic philosophy or Neoplatonism or various influences. And what if Judaism hadn't gone westward? What if we'd been exiled into the East, right? What if our history would have looked differently? We wouldn't have been spending, you know, two millennia dialoguing with Christianity and Islam, but we would have been dialoguing with Buddhism and Hinduism. What if this person is now making the journey that the Jewish people didn't? And what if orthopraxy is that which provides Judaism with continuity, and then all the rest is superstructure that somehow defines things differently? So yes, I naturally tend to say that the real, of course you have to buy into the faith and you have to buy into the path, and yet when people do these journeys in their own way, they are recreating a different kind of history, that ultimately there's something contingent about the way our particular history went there, took place. So the question is, are other syntheses and other patterns of Jewish life sustainable as long as they do not harm Jewish observance? Is Jewish observance enough, or must we insist on other elements as well? If someone has a different sense of reincarnation, the nature of being, ayin v'yesh, how do you say it? Being and non-being, duality, non-duality, the structure of the cosmos. Let's assume he's bought into another philosophical system. So because of that, has he totally moved out of Judaism? We're getting into very gray areas here. I would say that ultimately the criterion would have to be subjective rather than objective. It's not what you believe, but where you believe your salvation lies. If you believe that your ultimate spiritual path, that which leads you somewhere, is the home path, the path of Judaism, then that's the path you're following. If, on the other hand, you believe your ultimate salvation is Buddhism, Hinduism, whatever, and yet at the same time you're maintaining a Jewish practice, then that's where you are. You can argue with this, but at least it's a thesis I'm putting up for discussion, that it's the subjective sense of where you consider your religious path that defines where you are. And therefore, in case of multiple religious identities, the key question is, do you ultimately consider yourself not just to be Jewish, but to consider the Jewish path to be the path on which you're going? Well, in that case, the question, of course, presents itself. Then, what business do you have looking inside other traditions? If you assume that you are on a Jewish path, then what positive sense would there be for looking inside another tradition? And this leads me now to the third model, which is the model that I personally would endorse as, in my opinion, the more viable model for maintaining multiple religious affiliations. And this is the model of inspiration or borrowings, not changing religious identities, but a what I would call a more localized kind of borrowing. So if model one was defection, leaving the tradition, converting to another one. Model two was some attempt to hold on to two. Model three is being grounded deeply within your Judaism while drawing from in a significant way from another religion. Now, why borrow from another religion? You could, of course, say it's simply a problem of the individual. He's feeling alienated, and therefore our task is to help him to get past his alienation by showing him the beautiful side of Judaism. Okay, that works up to a point. What happens, I wasn't trying to be funny. What happens when you're faithful and when you're genuine, but you sense your tradition is in a crisis? When you sense that the tradition is unable to fulfill its own stated goals? What happens when you encounter people of a high spiritual grade in another spiritual tradition who are higher than the people you encounter in your own tradition, right? What happens when they have that impact on you? You want to maintain faithfulness to tradition, but suddenly you discover, hey, the guy in that tradition has actually gone a lot farther than any of the rabbis that I had in my yeshiva. What happens when you've experienced something by means of affiliation with another religion, some energetic opening of the heart? You simply had an experience while you were hosted by another religion that takes you way beyond anything you've experienced in your local synagogue. Now, if you take seriously the notion of galut, of exile, and the galut of the Shekhinah, and the galut of the divine presence, then you can come around and say, okay, there are things that are lacking, there are things that are in exile. And it's conceivable that some spiritual sustenance might be found outside Judaism. So how to deal with that while maintaining your religious identity? And I think this is a situation that touches many, and increasingly within today's religious world. I talk about people that sort of affiliate themselves sociologically with the same group I do by virtue of placing a particular patch of cloth on their head. Within those circles, you find increasingly this problem of youth of my ilk, you know, going to India, making their spiritual quest outside Judaism, feeling that there's something lacking. They want to be faithful, they want to be observant, they want to go on learning Gemara, but they want a higher spiritual realization that their tradition has provided them with. So, I would argue that there is a way, or it's conceivable, that one can learn or draw or receive from other religious traditions without that providing you with an alternative religious tradition, but actually as a form of enriching your own religious identity. And that typically what happens under those conditions is that a person attempts to rediscover that which he found in another tradition within his own tradition. Having received an inspiration from the outside, a person then turns to his or her own tradition in an attempt to find that at home. We're not dealing with change of basic loyalty. We're not dealing here with situations of alternative worship. We're not dealing here with situations of danger, error. We're dealing with people who, for all intents and purposes, following the four categories I outlined above, are willing to keep their sense of loyalty within Judaism, keep their lifestyle within Judaism, keep their worship within Judaism, and yet they feel the need for some kind of enrichment. And historically, there are models that justify this, justify or at least serve as some kind of precedent. The classical model is the Jewish Sufism of the Middle Ages. Maimonides' children, son, grandson, great-grandson, a movement that lasted in Egypt for about four generations, in which leading Jewish leaders of the Jewish community created a kind of synthesis of Judaism, fully halachic, with the influences of contemporary Muslim spirituality at its best. And the logic was, and this is the logic we'll get to back in a second, go, we had it and we lost it, they've kept it, and we're not taking from them. We're taking back that which rightly belongs to us. So there was a conscious process of justification, of adoption of Muslim prayer posture and prayer habits and prayer styles. And we're not dealing just about philosophy in a vague sense, we're dealing with something that actually affects the worship. It's the same God, but you would not recognize what the prayer of Rabbi Avraham Maimonides looked like, because it looks so different than... He recited the Amidah, but he recited it the whole style. First of all, there was quiet in that synagogue. I'm sure nobody spoke, but that's besides the point. Prostrations, body language, meditation, a host of influences all coming in from contemporary Sufi mysticism, shaping Jewish prayer, shaping Jewish spirituality. So the sense of rediscovery of that which was lost is an important strategy by means of which Jews have justified the process of borrowing. Classically, the argument has been made in the context of Jewish justification of dealing with philosophy. When Jews in the Middle Ages had to deal with the problem of how is it, or how do we justify the fact that we're learning Aristotle, we're learning Plato, we're learning all these things, after all, they're not in the Talmud, there were three strategies that were adopted. Right? The first strategy was, this is something originally Jewish, it was lost, and we're rediscovering it. Okay? So the same strategy that Abraham Maimonides uses for prayer, borrowing from the Sufis, was used by Jews to justify the study of philosophy. This is Jewish, we lost it. Okay? Just to give you some sense of it, Aristotle was a disciple of Shimon HaTzadik. Okay? Or Alexander the Great brings to Aristotle the writings of King Solomon, or better yet, Aristotle is Jewish. He comes. This may seem funny to you, but this was a very serious concern for Jews in the Middle Ages. How to justify dealing with traditions from the outside? He's a member. He comes from the tribe of Benjamin, and therefore, Jewish philosophy is native. It's not an outside invader. Okay, and therefore, we need to study Aristotle in order to reconstruct original Jewish thinking. Very interesting. This quest for origins. Listening yesterday to our presenters. They all, or virtually all, justified the fact that they were getting a complex religious identity through a return to some original pre-Galut kind of Judaism. Okay? Because there's always some sense that something has been lost from Judaism, and now because I've made affiliations with Hinduism or with Buddhism or with Sufism, or somehow I'm now touching on to something more authentic, more original. The true Judaism. So there's this quest for the true Judaism, and it's legitimate. I mean, it's perfectly legitimate for a person, it's legitimate from the perspective of the internal Jewish story to feel something has been lost and we have to rediscover it. Okay? Not everybody will agree that the way to rediscovering Judaism goes through Hare Krishna, but the fact is that the logic of rediscovery is part of how people account for borrowings, and they've been doing that now for 1,000 years. Now, this one strategy. A second strategy for justifying the study of philosophy was, we need it. For religious life, we need it. Not that this was Jewish, but it's simply necessary. There are certain things you won't be able to perform properly unless you have this knowledge. You need it for religious edification, you need it to fix the calendar, you need it to have a proper understanding of the religious life, to know who God is, etc. And the third answer is, a Jewish phrase in the Middle Ages, receive truth from whoever said it. Kabel ha'emet memi she'amaro. Whoever spoke the truth, receive the truth from him. And therefore, truth has some inherent value, regardless of what the source is. If it feels true, truth is one. Now, if you consider that Judaism had prophecy, had a different kind of ability to commune with God, etc., and things have disappeared from our spiritual horizon, it's not inconceivable that a person will attempt to rediscover certain things outside Judaism. Now, you could argue, of course, that there's a difference between studying philosophy and studying religion. Philosophy is neutral and religion is somehow marked. It belongs to another group. And I could also offer the counter argument, namely that what could be more logical for one religious than for one religious tradition to inspire another one? You want to study something and to rediscover what you've lost, go to people of the same ilk as yourself, i.e. other religious people, and get back whatever it is that you lost. So the philosophical argument in the Middle Ages was, that in order to come to the proper knowledge and love of God, you need philosophy. Now, if we take that argument and we apply it to the theme under discussion, could we argue that there are certain situations in which to come to a proper realization of the knowledge and love of God, you may need to borrow from Sufism, borrow from Christianity, borrow from Buddhism? Not because you want to change your identity, but because in order to fulfill those goals that are within your tradition, given the fact that there's a crisis, and given that the other guy seems to be doing better than you, why don't you get some help from him? You don't want to become like him, but you may need help from him to become yourself. And I would argue that this is a model that at least has historical precedent, both in Jewish Sufism and in the Jewish philosophy of the Middle Ages. And following that, I would like to offer the following direction as an orientation for encounter with other religions. If the search comes from a quest to deepen the love of God and his knowledge, then it may be a necessary evil, given the spiritual reality of our generation. If there's a fundamental commitment to the Jewish tradition, to its faith, to its way of life, to the halakha, to the recognition that it is a spiritual path, and along with that, there's a recognition that there's something lacking, something isn't working, then it may not be negative to draw on other traditions in a way that doesn't create another religious identity, but that helps you receive certain elements from that other religious tradition. Your identity is clear, it's defined, but how to actualize, I would claim here, unlike the first phenomenon, which is changing religious identity while trying to hold on to certain symbols of the original one, this phenomenon that I'm describing, which is being grounded in a religious identity and yet needing help, is not only a legitimate option under certain circumstances for individuals, but may also bring benefits to the tradition itself. The former possibility of conversion means that Stewie's children, within a generation or two, if he's successful in his education, will only know the name of Krishna. They will no longer have their Jewish affiliation. The second possibility means that the children of this person that we're talking about, who's gone to the ashram in India, who's gone to the Sufi master, they may have a deeper spiritual life in Judaism because their father has learned or their mother has learned how to pray with greater intensity and devotion than was taught to him in his own native tradition. So that the fruits of it are not only for the individual, but for the tradition itself. Now, the question is, when this, of course, opens up a whole subject for further reflection, then what are the legitimate or illegitimate parameters for borrowing? Can you bring in anything? Well, I've already said not worship. I think that's an important principle. Okay, I may go to monasteries, I may learn how to do Lectio Divina, I may learn how to do certain forms of meditation from the Benedictines, one thing or another. I shouldn't participate in the Mass. Okay, there's certain things that are, and I think this is an important term, technique. And I think on the level of technique, there's a lot to learn. There's a distinction that should be made between technique, which is how the other person does the same thing I need to do, but I just don't know how to do it, so he can teach me, and entering into someone else's field of worship. And as an orientating principle, I think it's important. Of course, in reality, there are some gray areas that we can't always define as clearly. And I'd like to finish with a text that has come up time and again in our discussion over the past weeks. If a person tells you there's wisdom amongst the Gentiles, believe him. If he tells them there's Torah amongst the Gentiles, do not believe him. So, drawing on this distinction between Chokhmah and Torah, I would argue those things that you can take to be Chokhmah, and well, let's define Chokhmah here. If the philosophers of the Middle Ages could define Chokhmah as that which leads to the love of God through the knowledge of God through Aristotelian philosophy, then I think it's a wide enough definition to allow a variety of techniques, ways of approaching the divine, processes of introspection, self-examination, forms of meditation. A lot of things can come into this wisdom, but it's not that I'm taking someone else's worship. So Torah is the commandment, the worship, the will of God, which is ultimately where our identity is drawn from. Chokhmah is where we may be able to receive inspiration from another religious tradition in a process of regaining that which was lost. And I think if we can come to terms seriously with the notion that our tradition is at present defective because we've lost things because of our history, biglal chata'enu, then we have to make space for seriously thinking about how the present situation is not only a curse and a problem, but also possibly a source of blessing and growth, not just for Jews, but also for Judaism. Thank you.
There were, however, a couple of points that not so much I disagree with as I just want to propose framing differently. In a sense, your conversation was an insider conversation within the halachic Jewish community among those who would be even willing to consider such things. What you laid out was a discourse appropriate to that community. The reality of the Jewish world is that, and I'm not somebody who always argues in favor of the majority, because generally the majority tends to be the mediocrity in spiritual terms, but in some sense we also have to take it into account. The majority, which in this case happens to include me, which also gives me an interest in it, the majority of Jewish people don't define themselves religiously basically in terms of the halakhic paradigm. And yet we're Jewish, and we are a large part of the Jewish community, the Jewish nation. This is not exactly Orthodox versus conservative reform, because there are conservative Jews here who are as serious about halakha as many Orthodox Jews, but it is. And one of the two, I think, root issues, that root causes of the problem, you know, of the poverty of spirituality in Judaism today, if we can say it that way, one of them is that the halakhic paradigm is a difficult paradigm in the world in which we live. In other words, to take mitzvot as the structure that reveals the will of God and to take that seriously, it's very difficult. So I would propose a third. There's the community that accepts Judaism as nationality, as ethnos. There's the community that accepts Judaism in its classic rabbinic presentation as halakha. And there's a community that wishes to take Judaism seriously as a tradition, as its tradition, and in some sense has to deal with halakha. Both Stephen and I talked about Shabbat being important for us. And if you're dealing with Shabbat, you're dealing in some sense with Hilchot Shabbat and Mitzvot of Shabbat. But I don't keep Shabbat because I really believe that's what God really wants me to do. I keep Shabbat because it feels right to me as a Jewish person, even if it doesn't exactly fit my Sufism or my Buddhism. That feels right aesthetically, spiritually, feels right to keep. And not because I believe that this is specifically what God commanded me on Mount Sinai. Okay, that's metaphor. Okay. So I wanted to widen the frame of your discourse to include also the community that relates to Judaism as its tradition, but not necessarily that relates to halakha as its tradition. And here we get into a bit of a distinction between religious tradition and spiritual tradition, religious authority and spiritual authority. And again, in many of the shikulim, many of the weighings and balances that you were discussing, there is the issue of what is the authority that you pursue? In some sense, some of us who've pursued spiritual paths outside Judaism have encountered something we would call spiritual authority, which has a higher order of authority than religious authority, especially since religious authority doesn't speak to us so strongly. Within that, I would argue there can continue to be... Now, Fackenheim states something that I hate, and yet I'm going to quote it. You know, that one of the mitzvot post-Holocaust is thou shalt give Hitler no further victories. I think along with that, there's a Jewish sensitivity that many of us feel when we look at certain things, of giving the triumphalism of other religions victories. So we don't want to give Christian triumphalism a victory. when I felt my Sufi Sheikh encouraging me into Islam, I felt in some sense that Islamic triumphalism wanted to take a ride on my spirituality, and there was something I felt there that, wait, that's not kosher, that's not cricket. And yet, the tension, if people do find spiritual authority outside of Judaism, I would argue that the creative tension of those who continue to see themselves as part of Jewish community and Jewish tradition, interacting with spiritual authority from outside Judaism, could be very important. And that's where I wanted to, just one further point in your talk, where you spoke of Jewish salvation, or salvation as framed by various religions. And here, I think maybe we also come to a root question of what do we mean by monotheism or monism or the oneness of God. Is there Jewish salvation that is different from spiritual salvation of other traditions that see the unity and transcendence of the Godhead, if I can put it that way? So let me leave those.
You really left me with a lot to think about, so let me just come to two points in your presentation and then some sort of answer, not an answer, but some sort of thinking in regard to the other speaker. First, I think the Shema, the unity of God, is absolutely fundamental in evaluating how we see ourselves, what this really means in a scientific world where everything is made of the same building blocks, which nobody talks about. What does it really mean to have the unity of God in other faiths, and how do they operate, and how can we as Jews, no matter what kind of Jews we are, that seems to be fundamentally built into our system of thinking, that we believe that God is one, and that the unity of the universe is really can be put together with that kind of thought. Secondly, in terms of Eastern religions, there's a very great difference between Hare Krishna Buddhism and, let us say, Hinduism, in terms of how one can relate to either one, because Hinduism is a multiplicity of godlike figures and gods, and you know, it's an entirely different kind of thought system, whereas Buddhism may not be such a fundamentally different kind of thought system. Now, in terms of the poverty of Jewish spiritual leaders, I think that's a very valid point. We have many authority figures in Judaism, but spirituality is a very unique concept. Maybe that's the the identification that Chabad has for so many people, because whatever Chabad stands for, it stands for a certain kind of spirituality that is unique. Yes, they have personified it in terms of the Rebbe, but basically it is a unique spiritual force that answers for many people. They start with that, then they go on to halacha. They don't start the other way, which is very, very important in the way many people think. So thank you.
Thank you.
I want to address something about the differences between conversion and conversation. And I use the concepts of a Catholic theologian, John Donne, that was speaking about passing over somebody of one religion, spending some years going into another religion, and then coming back to his own. And he was doing this exercise kind of methodologically. He was going to Islam, he was going to Buddhism, he was going to Gilgamesh, to the Babylonian thing. And I met him once in a conference in Jerusalem, and found that he wouldn't have the courage to try it with Judaism. Because somehow for his Catholicism, Judaism was too close. You could, as a Catholic, go to Buddhism and find a lot of very important and interesting things there, because it wasn't, in a sense, fundamentally threatening to your very basic tenets as a Catholic. But there were some very basic distinctions where those two, shall we call them sister religions, were, that was so close that if you took seriously some of those basic tenets, for a Jew, it will put in such a terrible question some of the basic dogmas of Catholicism. That's at least how I felt. So conversation could grow on the sense that there was enough basic distinction that could be maintained even through all this exercise. And it would act as a certain mental safeguard against the threat of conversion and against the threat of betrayal that may issue in this conversion. And I want to draw this attention also about what you mentioned now, this lady, about the monotheism of Judaism. Certainly this is something that's coming very much into question by modern, Israelis who are questioning the Judaism but not the Israelism. And I want to draw on Yehuda Libes, for instance, emphasize there was once a movement called that was disparaged, was called Canaanites, but was discovering a lot of interest with the former religions of the land of Israel. In order to understand better what is Yod Heh Vav Heh and what was its distinction. And I think that since Jews for many centuries were afraid of the God, hysterically afraid of the God, never pronouncing the name, never getting any closer, only some people in the Kabbalah dared to introduce this notion, which incidentally is very much like Catholicism, that's about the multiplicity. Sorry. But okay, I want just this thing of conversion conversation to suggest it as a possible criteria.
I want to thank you for your convincing arguments. I would find it even more convincing while you argued for multiple religious identities if this would have a carryover for multiple matrimonial identities. As you were talking, I could see myself applying your arguments for religious identities, saying, well, I don't find fulfillment and I'm looking for enrichment, I'm looking for rediscovery and things like that. Would you then argue for multiple mates, or would you argue for multiple, only successive mates after you've divorced one or the other? And because many of the things you argued about, you said towards the end, you know, you could learn from the other about technique. Would that have regarding a separate question, I don't want to make statement but question them. You started off by saying that perhaps it's better to have a spiritual life than to lead a secular life. Would you apply this argument regarding is it better amongst spiritual lives themselves, so that you have hierarchy of different identities, or are they all the same, as you suggest, because they all lead to the same path, to the same destination.
Barry, thanks.
I'd like to take some of the facts you presented and carry them a little further and question the model of Judaism that you've actually presented. When you look at biblical law and see its relationship to the Code of Hammurabi, or to Talmudic law and its relationship to the legal terminology of ancient Mesopotamia, or to the medieval Sufis and the philosophers, or to some of the modern developments in Judaism, I think we really have to ask ourselves if there was ever a time in which Judaism was out of touch with the surrounding cultures. Those people today who insist that is wrong and who are trying to develop an isolationist position and themselves are running around wearing the clothes of the Polish nobility of 200 years ago, are essentially fooling themselves into what this thing has been all about. Now, if that's the reality, then I think we have to ask a couple of very different questions. The first question is, does this lead to such a disunity in the Jewish people that we can't afford it? And the current situation may suggest that that is actually true. The second question that I have, in other words, if there are so many different factions in Judaism and it can be demonstrated that they are in fact the result of this kind of intercultural borrowing over the years, then maybe we have a real crisis that has to be dealt with by some form of attempt at unification among Jews, rather than the opposite. And this leads me to the question that I'd really like you to deal with, and that is, given everything that you said, do you imagine this operating on an individual level or a group level? Is somehow the Jewish people going to have to cope and decide whether it wants to be a little more Buddhist or a little more Christian or whatever, or is it going to allow every individual to go off and do this, his or herself, with the result that we will be even more fragmented than we are now, and God knows where that may lead?
A few points for comment, not my own comments. In Jewish tradition, there seems to be an argument whether we are to convert the rest of the world to Judaism or not. Almost no one would say we're to make anyone Jews. That's, we discourage it. But there is in the Rambam, Maimonides and all, a strong thing that we have to have every world, every person in the world, adopt the Jewish universal religion, the seven laws of Noah. According to Rambam, there is such a duty. And I think there's like at least a sense in much of the Jewish community that eventually the other religions will disappear. And people will just adopt the Torah and the seven laws of Noah. However, Rabbi Hershenson, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of the Jewish Quarter over 100 years ago, and Rabbi Ben Mosey, who was in Leghorn, who wrote the book about how we relate to other religions, Israel and the nations, both felt that at least Christianity and Islam, with which they were familiar, would remain, but in a little more purified version to get rid of non-Judaic idolatrous elements that kept in. So that's something to discuss. Another thing, I don't know in your discussions, if you had the idea of someone converting in order to convert the people to whom he's converting. I think an outstanding example, which is going to be published by Professor David Asaf, is Reb Moshe, the Baal HaTanya's son, the founder of Chabad, who became a Christian after his father's death. And he found an old book in English by another apostate in 1845, which implies that Reb Moshe's purpose was to talk the Christians out of worshiping God through pictures and statues and so forth. So it could be a messianic, a very early Chabad messianic attempt. And finally, I think there may be a problem in Judaism with what Yaakov discussed, with caring if one is inspired or not. Reb Soloveitchik sort of got me out of that. He said we copy Christians in looking at subjective inspiration as the criteria of religious validity, rather than a form of science. Since we know with the genome and all, as Clinton said, God's given us his language, we know that God made the world with abstract things, laws of science, which result in ultra-minute details. If you put a comma instead of a period in your internet, that you've just lost the whole thing. So if Soloveitchik's approach was, and I think it's Maimonides, that a true spirituality is not achieved by striving for inspiration or spirituality, but by realistically linking into God by learning his laws of Torah and science. And certainly in science, I think most people would say inspiration can even be harmful, getting your emotions involved. There is an emotional side of man, an aesthetic side. But that's not the essence. That would be Reb Soloveitchik's approach to what you mentioned. And finally, and when you mentioned about going to the east instead of the west, an intriguing thing which I never heard of, but we just happened to be in the west, Reb Kapach, who just died, great Torah scholar, huh? A couple of weeks ago. Yeah. That was at the funeral. There was thousands of people. Great, great man, maybe the world's greatest Torah scholar. His grandfather, he had one too, named Yichya, 100 years ago in Yemen, threw out the Zohar, absolutely banned it, as something Gosha and Treif, because it blended Eastern mysticism with Torah. And he wrote a book, Melchemet Hashem, showing it can't be Shem Ben Yochai, because he claims Shem Ben Yochai in the Talmud is a different person than in the Zohar. So it may have actually happened, and it's interesting that people who are attracted to Eastern things tend to turn to Zohar and that tradition. And I guess that may be it. Thank you.
After mentioning the postmodern problem of relativism and absolutism, I felt as if you proceeded then to facile that I dance between the two without differentiating between them. And what I mean to say is that you sometimes spoke of a path, and then you sometimes spoke of an essential truth that was lacking from Judaism and therefore needed to be put back in. The nafkamina to the two, the difference between the two would come when, if let's say you were sitting with me and I was an Orthodox Jew who was perfectly happy in my orthodoxy, would you then say, well, that's her path and that's fine? Or would you try and convince me that something was lacking from my Judaism and that I needed to go and look further afield as well? And that's the difference between the subjective and the objective.
I would have never used the term truth because I don't operate very much with the term truth. So I don't think in my entire lecture you heard the word truth. If anything, we were talking about in terms of experience, in terms of reality, I would apply a different vocabulary. I would say that, first of all, I would never argue with anyone that they needed to. The only thing I would argue with you was that you should perfect yourself as much as possible within your Judaism. The starting point of this whole presentation was a posteriori and not a priori. So I think that, you know, I tried to make that clear. And therefore, I neither spoke about anything essential nor about truth. To a certain extent, this is also the answer to your question, Ron, if I got your name right, which is this isn't, I mean, I'm already the therapist to whom the person is coming and talking about the fact that he's having this particular relationship. It's a difference between the situation. I'm not saying this is the ideal situation. This is the reality on the ground, and now we've got to cope and deal with it. The people in Masha'ir who refuse to deal with it, for better or for worse, they also won't talk to other women. What does that say? And do you talk to other women? In other words, are you only capable of recognizing one model, which is that of matrimony, and therefore women are there to be married? And therefore, if I have a wife, and if there's another woman that's of any relevance to me, then she's either there as my parallel wife or serial wife or whatever. Or do you recognize a multiplicity of roles for women in your life, including therapist or friend or sister-in-law or other things that may be relevant? And is it conceivable that even though you may have a good marriage with your wife, there still may be something you can benefit from a good relationship with your sister-in-law? You have to answer that, but I think my very point was that matrimony is not the exclusive metaphor relationship with women, if you wanted to transfer that. So my whole argument was that we can entertain other relationships with other religions precisely because we can think of them not in terms of full religious identity, but of something more specific and more focused. And therefore, your question, cute as it was for more reasons than you may know, is actually phrasing my thesis in a way that's misleading, because the one thing I didn't argue for was multiple marriages. The other question you raise is that's, I think, a very intriguing one, which is, this was a little bit the question Yael asked, but in a different way, which is, am I espousing a relativism in which everything is the same as long as you call it spiritual life? It all gets you to the same place, so who cares where you go as long as you're enriched? Or, given the fact that if in the context, someone sits in front of you and says, look, I'm debating whether I should be a Jewish Buddhist or a Jewish Sufi, do I also have what to tell them? I think that's a very important question to reflect on. I personally would answer yes, that there are various hierarchies. And I was just giving a very, very bare sketch, and of course we would have to fill this in with a lot of details. One clarification to you. Our teacher for whole Hinduism doesn't accept your definition for Hinduism, so either you're right or she's right, to be continued. Okay, but whatever. But I'm not sure things are as simple as you suggest they are with Hinduism. And the last thing that I recognize here in the form of a question is Barry's question, which is, how is this thing going to happen? I'm not sure this is the right question, because it is happening. What? I suspect, I mean, it's not how I want to. The only thing I can say is, how do I sense it's going to go? What's my hunch of the direction that it's going to go? My sense of where it's going to go is through individuals amalgamating into small communities, creating change over the generations. In the same way the change in the status of women is taking place, in the same way the change in the nature of Jewish prayer is taking place, various individuals, look, our situation, grosso modo, is that for lack of religious leadership that is able to effect change, changes happen from below.